Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and you know, finance ain't easy, especially for kids like this one.
I kind of got really mad.
That's young Tommy Beckman of St. Louis with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Tommy's already got some experience managing cash and the frustrations that go with it. Listen once more.
I kind of got really mad.
So here's a quiz. What made this kid so peeved? Was it A, learning how to use an allowance? It's hard being a youngin' on $5 a week. Or was Tommy mad about B, losing credit card privileges? Some parents are giving their kids a line of credit so they can download music. Or was Tommy enraged by C, losing at Monopoly for the first time? The board game is 72 years old this year. No clue? Don't pitch a fit. The answer is coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
Mom, can I have that? Will you buy me that? Well, no, but you can buy it for yourself. This week, we are making allowances, if you're good. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
Kids have all kinds of stuff these days. So many toys, so many games, often courtesy of generous friends and grandparents. Do they even need an allowance? Well, according to the market research firm Yankelovich Partners, more than half of U.S. kids do get a regular allowance. Other studies have put the number at about a third. Well, we know from the mail we get here at Marketplace that lots of parents are still confused about allowances, when to start, how much to give, whether to give one at all. So we asked Ashley Milne-Tite to do some investigating.
If only about half of kids get an allowance, where does that leave the finances of the other half? John and Eileen Gallo co-wrote The Financially Intelligent Parent. They say parents who don't give an allowance usually tell them they just buy whatever their kids need.
And our response is, well, that's nice, but you're taking away from your child the ability to learn to make choices.
Giving a child an allowance is an opportunity to help them develop a basic life skill, which is money management.
The Gallos say parents can begin an allowance when their child is around 6 years old. As for the amount, that's the hard part. You could start a child off on an allowance that matches their age. That's what happened to Tommy Beckman of St. Louis. When he was five, his mother got sick of him whining for stuff. She gave him $5 in cash each week. Now 12, Tommy says he's a good saver, but it took some getting used to.
Sometimes when I there was something I really wanted, but it cost too much. I kind of got really mad because I knew the system was working and that she wouldn't buy it for me, and I'd have to like wait 2 more weeks or so to buy it.
Nowadays, he banks at home. Each Saturday, his mom marks a kitchen calendar with another $5.
So he really now is on a system where I'm keeping an account for him.
Sophie Beckman admits she's a natural at managing money. She works at brokerage firm A.G. Edwards, but she says any parent can benefit from handing out an allowance.
I do think that the system is very efficient and keeps me from spending too much money on his constant requests.
But some parents find it tough not to spoil the kids, even if they have an allowance. Just think of what lurks in the nebulous online economy, like those 99-cent songs from iTunes. You can't pay cash for online songs, so some parents give their kids debit or credit cards linked to their own account. Janet Bodner says that's a big mistake. She's an editor at Kiplinger's Magazine and the author of Money Smart Kids.
Anything that is not cash money for kids is not real. They don't really draw a distinction between prepaid debit versus credit. It's all just kind of magic money. Mom and dad can top up the card if the card runs low.
She says an allowance should be cash, period. If a child wants to buy something online, they should first pay the parent out of their allowance, then the parent can use their credit card to make the purchase. But do allowances matter today? So many parents can give their kids almost anything they want, like the Manhattan mother I spoke to who didn't want to go on tape. Her daughter wasn't available to comment because she's on vacation in the Caribbean, courtesy of a friend's parents. She's 16 and has an allowance of $100 a week and a credit card so she can keep up with her fashion-conscious crowd. But Janet Bodner says just because you can doesn't mean you should.
What you have to remember is you are not obligated to pay for everything that your child wants to do.
12-year-old Tommy Beckman said goodbye to instant gratification as soon as he got his allowance, and he's thankful.
Because I became a lot smarter in, like, money wisdom with spending and saving and knowing, like, the necessities that I will need and, like, stuff that I really don't need but I want.
Now that he's come on air to talk about his allowance, maybe he can finally get a raise. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivin Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at NASDFoundation.org.
The TJX company revealed this week that information from more than 45 million credit and debit cards was stolen from its stores. TJX owns TJ Maxx, Marshalls, and other retailers. Most of those customers probably would have been fine with their credit card companies canceling the cards. But sometimes that happens even if there hasn't been any fraud. The card company just thinks there might have been and shuts off your card. So it got us curious, just how do they define suspicious? Ted Crooks is Vice President of Products for Global Analytics. Mr. Crooks, first of all, just how bad is the fraud problem?
It's used by almost all forms of organized crime as a form of working capital and a way to get anonymous funds. And as a result, every time the banks do something to try and reduce fraud without making things too inconvenient for consumers, at the same time, the fraudsters adapt.
So how does the credit card industry come up with its methods for tamping down on this kind of thing? What's the math behind this?
The solution that's in place today is one developed about 15 years ago. It's used by 85 or 90% of all bank cards in the United States. And that's a system that uses a neural network.
What do you mean by a neural network?
We were trying to build something that was like the old-fashioned bank teller in a small town who was a little too nosy and knew everybody's business and could tell when things were fishy. And in fact, programming common sense like that's next to impossible. But it was possible to build a program to learn common sense within a narrow field of knowledge. So we've built these programs that learn how people behave with their credit cards and learns different kinds of people and different sorts of behavior. And then it goes on to learn about each individual account and how it normally behaves.
But the computers really don't have common sense. So, you know, we've heard stories here at Marketplace about people getting, you know, alerts or having their credit cards put on hold for even going to, you know, a new gas station and the credit card is declined. Is there a way to balance the convenience that the consumer needs with everybody's need to, you know, not have fraudulent credit card use?
What you don't know is the 120 other cards that went through that gas station earlier in the day, 85 of which were stolen. Then all of a sudden, your card looks like maybe it's stolen.
Wow.
Those are the kinds of things that do happen.
Yeah.
But overall, the system today loses about 6 cents out of every $100 goes to fraud, a lot less than goes to other inefficiencies in the system. And generally, credit cards are very convenient to use. But we're going to live with a certain amount of fraud, and we're going to do better mathematics. The next step after neural networks, the things that we're working on these days, are systems that use antibody approaches.
How does the antibody system work?
It looks at hundreds of millions of possible combinations of transactions and recognizes those that individual fraudsters or fraud rings have found popular lately.
And it seems like as consumers, we just kind of have to get used to the fact that sometimes our cards may be shut off because of this mathematical algorithm that's telling the card company that there might be something wrong.
That's exactly right. And the best solutions carry two cards from two different banks. And read your statements. Make sure nobody else is using your card.
Ted Crooks is Vice President of Products for Global Analytics. Thanks so much for coming in. And I promise I won't make fun of your last name.
That's quite all right. I didn't choose it.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Easter's next weekend, and you know what that means. One more week of walking past that expanded candy section right at the front of the grocery store and trying not to buy any marshmallow peeps. According to a new study, though, the more you struggle to control your inner peepaholic or shopaholic, the more you could be vulnerable to other urges down the line. Here to explain is the co-author of that study. Ron Faber is a professor and consumer researcher at the University of Minnesota. Mr. Faber, thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Talk to me a little bit about how you conducted these experiments. What did you ask your subjects to do?
We do two different tasks. In the first task, we make people use up what are known as self-regulatory resources.
By this, you mean depleting their ability to say no.
Yes. They have to pay attention to something. They have to behave in some way. They might have to think about something. And all of these reduce our resources to be able to exert self-control.
Hmm.
The second task involved assessing impulse buying. And our basic idea was that if you use up these resources that you need to engage in control of your behavior or your spending, that you will then have a harder time and you will spend more.
This sounds very much like the advice that you get all the time in dieting, that you can't deny yourself everything because otherwise you won't deny yourself anything.
That's true. And in fact, if you're on a diet, it's harder to avoid impulse buying.
Really?
Yes.
Now, how does that work?
Well, we think that people have just one basic set of resources that they use for control. And we have all sorts of goals in our life. And in order to maintain those goals, we have to exert control to not do other things that would take away from these. And as we exert control in one area of our life, we're less able to do it in some other areas or in some other situation. But this is a short-term thing. And so if we wait 5-10 minutes, then our resources are replenished.
Minutes?
Yeah, fairly short.
So what does that tell us about how our brain works when we're out shopping?
I think it basically says the more decisions we have to make, the more stress we're under, the less able we are to exert control. And it tells us that if we're trying to save money, we might want to do things like not go shopping right after we've had a very hectic day, or we may not want to buy lots in a long period of time. So you may not want to go shopping for 2 or 3 hours, but instead go in several shorter shopping trips.
All right. Ron Faber is the co-author with Kathleen Voss of a paper entitled Spent Resources. And you can find that in the latest Journal of Consumer Research. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Your home won't sell and you need to buy a new one. Chris does the math in the mailbag. And here's a guy who's really attached to his boss.
If he wants to buy something off Amazon at 3 a.m., I'm awakened at 3 a.m. to fetch one of his Amex cards.
A day in the work life of a wallet carrier. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. According to Forbes, it's getting less lonely at the top. Earlier this month, the magazine released its list of the world's billionaires. Their ranks grew by 19% over last year. Of course, behind each one of them is an army of helpers. On today's A Day in the Work Life, we meet one of those little people.
Okay, we're in the conference room of a very fancy hotel. Actually, I'm in the smoking area right outside the conference room. My employer is in the conference room, and I do this a lot. I just stay near the boss and wait for him to... Oh, that's him. Just a second. Yes, sir. My name is Keenan Hershiser.
Got it.
And my job is to carry a very wealthy man's wallet.
Yes, sir. Right away.
He needs a quarter to flip there, making a bet. But we can talk for a few more minutes. Actually, do you mind if I run in and get him that real fast? Thank you. Actually, I can't tell you my boss's name because then folks might try to follow me around to get to him. But I can tell you, you've heard of the Fortune 500 wealthiest men in the world. He's like number 504. Now I say I carry his wallet. That's to be kind of, you know, funny. It's more of a backpack. I have his credit cards, all 93 of them, and his stock portfolio. Quite literally, he likes to carry actual paper stocks. It's a quirk of his. And then the stocks you can't get on paper, I keep in this laptop computer, which I can hook up via satellite to most world markets and trade for him. Family pictures, of course. Sometimes he asks me to show him the picture of his child by a second wife, and he, you know, cries. See, you have to understand, you don't just carry the wallet of a man like this. You kind of become his wallet. So I sleep in a... it's bigger than a closet. I'd call it a small bedroom, right off his bedroom. And if he wants to buy something off Amazon at 3 a.m., I'm awakened at 3 a.m. to fetch one of his Amex cards. And if he takes a drive, I'm in the back seat because I have his license. I go to all his appointments. For security reasons, I usually don't know where we're going, so if I get stolen... stolen, that's what he calls it if someone were to kidnap me. If I were stolen, I wouldn't be able to tell my captors where to find him. So I have begun some days right here in Pasadena and ended the day in Guam. Most interesting day I have had on the job. There was one time the boss told me to load the wallet only with hundreds, and we had a very nice dinner with Donald Trump, who I, for some reason, won't touch 20s or any denomination bill below 100 he doesn't want to touch. So that was interesting. Do I have to say this? Okay. It's not... Let's just say I make between $500,000 to $600,000 per year. But I should add, I tithe 10% of that to charity. And, of course, my therapist gets his cut. Yeah. If I could do another job, I would like to be a baggage handler. Because I've proven I can handle people's valuable things. I imagine the bosses kind of talk to you. You know, like have a conversation with you sometimes. And also, I think I'd work more days because as it is, I only work one day a year, right at the beginning of April.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Joe King and written by Rico Galliano.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
A red letter day for the stock market brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, M. The letter M is a ticker symbol on the New York Stock Exchange. It was assigned to Macy's Inc. this week. That's a big deal for two reasons. Exhibit A. Companies covet one-letter symbols because, well, there's only 26. Exhibit B. Most analysts assumed the M symbol would go to Microsoft if the software giant ever listed on the New York Exchange. Right now, the company lists on the NASDAQ, where most companies have four-letter symbols. Maybe Microsoft will get a new one for itself. D-A-R-N.
Got a box full of letters. Think you might like to read.
I'm I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the time in the show where we listen to you. And I'm joined, of course, by our economics expert, Chris Farrell. Together, we're going to try to figure out all the solutions to your financial problems. Hey, Chris.
Hi, how you doing, Tess?
We're doing all right. We're going to figure out all the solutions, right?
I was just going to say all the solutions. Well, maybe we'll give a hint or two. How's that?
Okay, sounds good. But before we get to that, please take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there. Or you can give us a call. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Well, there are a lot of people who feel that one way to look at a crowded house is to think of it as cozy. But if you ask our next caller, a couple of recent family additions make her house seem downright congested. Joy is calling from Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. Hey, Joy.
Hi.
So tell us about where you live.
We live in a one-bedroom townhome in Bloomfield Hills. I purchased it right before I met my husband, and we now have a 17-month-old and a 13-week-old and all the stuff that comes with them.
And I'm guessing I'm hearing the 13-week-old there in the background.
Yes, he's a fat and happy boy, just got fed, and he's excited to hear mommy talk right now. So.
Well, congratulations on your two additions to your home.
Thank you very much.
So what's your question for Chris this week?
Our questions are, we are in Michigan, which obviously is one of the hardest hit states, and we are not wanting to move up because, oh, we can get a good deal on a house right now. We're wanting to move because we need to, and we've had our house on the market for a year and 3 months now. And have not even had an offer. Our price is so low right now. It's basically just getting out of the mortgage.
How far down have you dropped it?
We've come from like 150 down to 120-something. Hello?
Oh, hello.
Hello. Oh, you know what? I think my other son just got on the phone. Sorry about that.
Quite all right. Quite all, if he does have a question, you can let us know and you can call us back later.
Okay.
So what are kind of the options that you're exploring right now?
You know, we've talked to the bank about a short sale, and they won't even work with us until we start skipping payments. My question is, if it goes into foreclosure...
Wait a minute. So you're thinking about actively going into foreclosure as your option?
If need be. Our hand has kind of been forced here.
Hmm. Okay. I think we need to do a little definitions here, Tess. Obviously, Joy, you've done a lot of research. The term short sale that Joy was just using is you go to the bank and you say, okay, let's say the home's on the market for $100,000, you can sell it for $50,000, and the bank accepts it.
And it's not foreclosure.
And it's not foreclosure. Hmm. And you usually do have, by the way, a tax liability.
Okay.
Because the bank is, in essence, in the example that I use, forgiving $50,000 of the loan. So the IRS looks at that and says, well, you got a benefit from that, and therefore you usually have to pay taxes on it, which is usually a fairly painful thing to do. But,
okay.
You know, that is one possibility. And the other thing is foreclosure, which is a thing that's happening all around the country. In essence, you go into default. There's a foreclosure sale. And then the bank can come back at you and say, you get a judgment against you. It will have an impact on your credit. You know, if you wanted to go out and get another home, another mortgage, depending on your circumstances, it could really spill over and have an impact. Most of the foreclosures that we're seeing, people are being forced into foreclosure. It's no longer affordable. And so they're involuntarily losing their house. You're in a situation where, you know, you can meet the mortgage payments. You're going to have a tough living situation for a while. But hopefully a year or two, you know, you can get yourself out of it. And even if you take a small loss, that'd be fine just to get out of there.
So, Joy, is there any chance that you could just stay in this house for a little while, despite the fact that it's cramped?
Yeah, well, I thought that, you know, I mean, that's what's going to end up happening if those are the consequences. We're going to end up, you know, just waiting. And
yeah, foreclosure is a very, very serious financial risk.
It is. And like I said, we're trying to, you know, avoid everything like that, and we're going to have to build on the inside somehow, you know, build out, because we have a really big bedroom that could be two, you know, just something like that we may have to look into.
All right. Well, best of luck in this tough time, and tell you what, we're going to check back with you and see how things are going.
Great. Thank you very much for all your help.
Take care. Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Well, it is time to stop procrastinating, folks, because April is upon us, as we're all well aware. And if you've got a question about filing your taxes, check out our latest Marketplace Money clip. You can see Chris on video. He's got some advice for all you tax filers. And even if you wait up till the last minute, just visit our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the Money Clip link. All right, back to the emails we go, Chris. Tim writes in from Iowa City, Iowa, and he received two shares of Heinz stock in 1976, promptly forgot about it. But recently, when he tried to catch up to it, let's move on. Anyway, he found out that it went from $20 a share to more than $1,300 a share. So he wants to sell it, but he doesn't have a brokerage account. And the bad news here is that the management company is going to charge him a 15% commission to sell these two shares of stock. Any alternative for him here, or are they just going to get his money?
You know, there's a couple alternatives, at least to pursue. I don't know which one is going to work out. One is to contact the Heinz directly. I know that they have a dividend reinvestment plan. And so call the Heinz investment office, give them the joke about ketchup. I'm sure they have never heard that before. and then see if I can do a transfer to them. You don't have a brokerage account, but my guess is you have a 401k, 403b, maybe an IRA, some sort of retirement savings plan. My guess is they'll have a brokerage operation. So you might be able to get a decent deal that way. Again, call Heinz first and then check with your provider of your retirement savings plan and see if you can do a more advantageous deal for yourself.
Who knew condiments could be so rewarding? Well, if you've got questions about anything financially related, we would relish the opportunity to answer them for you. Oh, I need to stop now. That is what we're here for. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org, or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Well, you know, we ask for your financial questions all the time, and we've gotten some pretty unusual ones over the years. But when we heard about the situation from our next caller, even we were a little floored. Cynthia is calling from Mountaintop, Pennsylvania. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
So why don't you tell us what happened?
My husband and I took our 18-year-old daughter to go get her very own cell phone. She signed up, of course, to open an account and so forth. And shortly thereafter, we received a letter from a company called RiskWise. And the letter was requesting all kinds of information, such as her birth certificate, her W-2 form. And it wasn't actually from a consumer reporting agency, but a company called RiskWise, which I'd never heard of.
Chris, you've done a little research into this. What are we looking at here?
Well, what you're looking at, RiskWise, is a subsidiary of NexusLexis, and it's a legitimate company. And Cynthia faxed me the letter that they had sent in, and there were two columns. So you had, you know, your Social Security number, driver's license, and then W-2 form.
And here's one that really got me. It says any other official document containing your Social Security number. Please give us anything that has your Social Security number on it. What?
And your birth certificate.
Yeah.
Which is incredibly important. I mean, it was so revealing.
In fact, by the way, folks, we'll go ahead and put a copy of this letter up on our website, marketplace.org, so you can take a look at it. So, Chris, what would the purpose of this letter be for this company?
Well, what they're really trying to do is, I mean, look, teenagers are the growth market because by definition, they don't have credit. They're a new customer. And the thing that I think is really upsetting, and it's a stunning figure, is that more than 30% of all cases of identity theft involve teenagers.
Wow.
And it makes sense once you think about it, which is that because they have unblemished credit records, this can go on once their identity is stolen. It can be undetected for years. And I really have only one action to say to a letter like that, which is shred it.
Yep.
It was absolutely, I think that it is unconscionable in today's world where we worry a lot about identity theft, that a letter is sent asking for that kind of information. Don't ever fill it out. It's just, it is a legitimate company, but.
But you shouldn't have to go through this process to establish a credit record.
Right.
Absolutely. And you don't need to. I mean, that's the bottom line, is you don't need to. So toss it away, throw it away, get rid of it.
All right. Well, some lessons for all of us, including your teenage daughter there. So thanks for alerting us to this.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I love your show.
All right. Thanks for the call.
All right.
There are lots of people out there that say they want to help you with your finances, but all they're concerned with is lining their own pockets. That is not us. All we need is your name, your telephone number, and your financial question. Give us a call. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our website. It's marketplace.org and click on contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right. How about we hit the email bag one more time, Chris? You ready?
Okay. Yep.
Okay. We've got Neil from Monterrey, Mexico. And his brother is the primary caregiver for their elderly mother. And his wife, Neil's wife, is a Foreign Service officer. And so they're going to be living outside the U.S. A whole lot of the time. And he already kind of helps out with his mother's care by a direct deposit into a checking account. But he wants to do more. So here's his question. He wants to know if it's a good idea to provide his brother with a credit card for emergency purposes. Of course, handing over a credit card, no matter who it's to, always carries some measure of risk. He wants to know if there's any better way of getting some money to help with the care of his mother.
As an outsider trying to give good advice, I would say don't hand over a credit card.
Yeah.
There's really two things that you can do. One is, in today's world, with cell phones and internet, even though you're outside of the country, it's pretty hard to be out of touch for any length of time. His brother can probably get in touch with him right away in case of an emergency. Then he can always use his credit card at that point, you know, call up the institution. The other thing is he already has the direct deposit into the checking account. I'd be emphasizing building up my emergency savings because there might be a draw that's coming on. And then if that does, your brother calls you, you say, no problem. I'm going to go right on the internet. I'm going to do a wire transfer. I'm going to get the money right in there that you're going to need. And then, you know, he and his brother can get together maybe every once in a while, or at least, you know, set up a time on the phone and just make sure that, you know, everything's going smoothly on the financial side of things. Because a lot of times, the issue is less the money and more the communication, and that everyone feels that they're being fair and being helpful. So that's what I'd actually focus on, because I think they've actually got it pretty well covered here.
All right. I hope that helps you out, Neil. That's all the questions we can take on this week's show, but leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY, or visit our contact page on our website, marketplace.org. Thanks, as always, for sound financial advice, Chris.
Okay, bye now.
You pop the question, yippee! Then comes the yelp, merging the money.
He would have huge wads of cash in his pocket. At first thought he was just trying to impress me. Well, then I realized there was a 20 on the outside and it was all ones on
Whatever.
The inside.
We begin a new series that takes you inside the lives of an engaged couple. What happens as they plan for wedding bliss and wedded bills? Plus, the next generation of prescription drugs might hurt your healthcare plan. That's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Once upon a time in the kingdom of Encinitas, California, a girl and a boy met and fell in love.
My name is Tiffany Leungren.
My name is Michael Fox.
We've been together a little more than a year, but we've known each other since high school.
After several months of courting, they decided to make it official. Before a large assembly of family, Michael presented Tiffany with a ring.
We got engaged December 29th, 2006, and we're getting married September 1st, 2007.
First comes love, then comes marriage, then comes the merging of two financial lives. For the next 5 months, we'll be following the fairy tale of Tiffany and Mike as they walk toward the aisle to have and to hold through sickness and health and revolving credit card debt. Our heroine, Tiffany, is 31 and writes for the website of the University of California at San Diego. She's also a freelance journalist and makes around $55,000 a year. Our hero, Mike, is 30, and he's the CFO for a real estate development company he started with his friends. His salary is about $30,000 a year, which he hopes will grow with his company. Tiffany and Mike have very different financial pasts.
I have to say that I wasn't always the most responsible person when it came to money, mainly because I was always in so much debt that it was depressing to me and I didn't feel like dealing with it. Sometimes would engage in a little retail therapy, even knowing I didn't have the money to be spending. But I realized that that was a no-end downward spiral situation and stopped doing that.
Can you give us an idea of what you mean and what kind of debt it was?
Well, I had student loan debt, and I still do.
How much do you owe right now on your student loans?
On my student loans, I think I owe about $11,000. I also have an auto loan. I think my debt all in total amounts to about between $15,000 and $20,000.
And Michael, how about your money management prior to the relationship?
Of course, my early 20s, I did like the Night at the Roxbury type thing. It was like, I was one of those guys, I'm pretty sure, credit card debt and whatnot, and went through fixing my credit. My truck is paid off. I have a dentist bill. I owe about $3,000.
But at least now, he's using a bank account.
I bartended for a while. It was a lot of cash money. And I take it into the bank like I was a big money guy. And I carry around a lot of money for some ridiculous reasons.
When we first started dating, he would have huge wads of cash in his pocket. At first thought he was just trying to impress me. Well, then I realized there was a 20 on the outside and it was all ones on
whatever.
The inside. No, not.
Then once you start dating a woman, though, the money, let's see.
Wads get a little smaller.
I have $20 in my pocket now.
At that point, Tiffany gets up from the dining room table and walks to the kitchen. They just bought their house in February. As she makes tea for the two of them, she's reminded of how things change when you meet your knight in shining armor and he's into shiny electronics.
And this teapot I brought back from Vietnam. And it's funny because Mike told me the price of the TV he wants to get. And when I think of, you know, $800 to $1,000, I think round-trip plane ticket. He thinks flat-screen TV. So that's something that is new to us, having to prioritize and debate what is really important to us, you know. What kind do you want, sweetie?
Like the orange kind.
The orange kind.
The day of our visit, they plan to open their first joint bank account. But it's a new idea for them, this notion of pooling their money. They're also keeping their separate accounts for non-shared expenses, but it's all an experiment at this point.
Everybody pretty much has said, you know, you start off with your own accounts, and then it eventually, they all become one account. The problem is when you start going out is you have your own personal account, and she has hers. Well, when you're paying for dinner, do you pay out of your personal account because you're the guy you normally used to pay for it? And now that you're married, do you pay out of the joint account? And right now, Tiffany is making, you know, pretty considerably double my income. And so when she says she wants to go on a vacation, hey, you know what? You make enough money to go on vacation. She should be going on vacations.
When Mike and I first started dating, we would go to dinner and I would pull out my wallet every time. Like, I was going to pay my portion. And he'd always kind of wave it off and, oh, I got it. Living together has changed that somewhat. Because having one account or working from one base of money is easier. I don't know how people do it, though. I don't know. I saw a woman in the farmer's market who was looking at vegetables, and then the vegetable seller asked her if she wanted something, and she said, hold on, I have to go get my husband. He has the money. It just seems so old-fashioned to me.
Why not just have one joint account?
Well, I think it's more my issue with a single account than Mike's issue with it. I just don't feel like it's fair if I make more money to have him pay for things like my cosmetics. But if I have the extra cash, then I feel like I shouldn't have to ask permission to buy those things.
Or feel guilty about it.
But I think we also trust each other that we're not squirreling away money and spending it on stupid things or doing anything like that. You have to have a basic trust.
And with that, we close our first chapter in this fairy tale as Mike and Tiffany go hand in hand to the credit union. Next month, chapter 2, where they discover how their upbringing has influenced their notions of money. Pictures of our hero and heroine are on our website, marketplace.org.
Mike?
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
If you filed your taxes already, it's probably because you're getting a refund. No need to wait until the last minute when you're not the one writing the check. The IRS says the average refund is about $2,500 this year. But before you celebrate, think about this. Getting a refund means you could be losing money. Bankrate.com's Kay Bell explains.
It's better to pay as much as you can to get as close to your actual tax bill as possible. If you have to write a check to the IRS, that's not bad as long as it's a small check. A lot of people like to get those refunds, but that's really not very smart. Basically, you're giving Uncle Sam an interest-free loan on your money. Hmm. He's had that money all year. You could have had it, and I know interest rates have not been that good for savings vehicles recently, but still, that should be money that you're making money on. So if you're getting back a big refund regularly, think about adjusting your W-4 so that you can get that money back yourself. And if you're afraid that you're going to spend it, if you don't think you have the discipline to make good use of that money, say you're getting back $50 a paycheck when you adjust your withholding, have that money directly deposited into a savings account.
You can listen to my full interview with Kay on our website, marketplace.org. For the podcast, just click on the tax file link. Ever heard of biologics? Yeah, I hadn't either. They're the most expensive pharmaceuticals on the market, and yet you've probably never seen a commercial for them, which should tell you something. Every pill seems to have its own public pitch, complete with some long disclaimer about how it might give you massive headaches and turn your teeth green. But these specialty drugs don't have ad campaigns. This week, the FDA announced more research is needed for possible cheaper generic versions. Andrea Smartin reports.
Darren Baker is a chemist. He works for a company called Biogen IDEC in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The company produces biologic drugs to treat people with diseases like cancer and multiple sclerosis. Baker works on isolating proteins that will be the basis for the next drugs. The potential life-saving proteins have to be stored at very cold temperatures.
So as you can see, you know, my freezer is completely chock-a-block. So we have proteins, for example, here. These are purified.
Unlike traditional pharmaceuticals, biologics are made from living cells. The hope is that essential proteins from the cells will eventually be delivered to patients through injections or infusions. Baker has always believed that his work is important, but when a doctor found a grapefruit-sized tumor in his chest, the work became personal.
Yeah, those are my kids, my son Cameron, who's 9, and my daughter Jackie, who'll be 7.
Baker points to photos on the walls of his small corner office, pictures of him with his 2 children on fishing trips, relatives who have died, some from cancer.
This is my great auntie Mary, who passed away last year from pancreatic cancer. That's both my mom and my grandmother, both have passed away.
Baker was diagnosed with B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 2003. His oncologist suggested traditional chemotherapy as well as a specialty drug called Rituxan. Baker was all for it. Rituxan is produced by his colleagues at Biogen IDEC.
My own experience with cancer and being treated with my own company's drug really brought it home, you know, what we do, what I do, what my colleagues do in making drugs to significantly improve people's lives.
At the time, Rituxan wasn't approved yet for the type of lymphoma Baker had. But as a scientist, he did his research, talked to his colleagues. He was optimistic.
Hopefully my colleagues have got it right, because now their drug was going in my veins, so...
3 years later, Baker is cancer-free. But specialty drugs like Rituxan don't come cheap, and the cost gets passed on to all of us in the form of higher premiums. Matthew Cannell is director of pharmacy services at Blue Cross Blue Shield. It's the largest insurer in Massachusetts. He says many new specialty drugs are coming on the market, and there are rapidly growing medical costs.
Well, if we look at 2005, there's roughly $40 billion worth of specialty drug spend in the U.S. We project that it could be $90 billion by 2009, so essentially more than doubling in 4 years.
At Blue Cross Blue Shield, 20% of its pharmaceutical costs come from specialty drugs, but less than 1% of its members are taking them. This is because the drugs can cost as much as $200,000 a year for one patient. Biogen IDEX spokesman Tim Hunt says it typically takes about $1 billion to develop each one.
And then you realize that probably 7 out of 10 products that do get approved by the FDA end up being kind of a net loser financially to a corporation. That's a pretty big expense.
Insurance companies have been able to reduce pharmaceutical costs by offering generics, but that's not an option with biologics. According to Hunt, the process of extracting proteins from living cells is far more complicated than making a standard pharmaceutical pill.
That makes it much, much, much more difficult to replicate them in a generic form, which is why there really will probably never be true generic biologics.
Insurance companies claim specialty drugs are likely to continue driving up medical costs. So is it worth it? Ask Darren Baker.
Well, I'm here. I'm not in remission. The fact that I'm here working in the drug industry, making other drugs, providing for my family, my kids have their father, my wife has a husband. I mean, absolutely worth every penny.
Those pennies could add up to healthy revenue growth for specialty drug developers in the years to come. In Boston, I'm Andrea Smartin for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
looks like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor Chris Farrell to help you sort out what's smart, what is stupid, and what's the straight story. Now, Chris, the New York Times ran a pretty disturbing story about long-term health care insurance this week. I know you saw it.
I did.
All right. But for those who didn't, the headline of the piece really said it all to me. Aged, frail, and denied care by their insurers. Now, Chris, really, is the long-term care industry as bad as it sounds in this piece?
Let me answer with a number, and it comes from the story. And I think the number speaks volumes. Nearly 1 in 4 long-term insurance claims in California is denied.
Ouch.
That means thousands of people, pay big premiums for years, only be told when they need the money, they're out of luck. I think Bob Dylan, I love Bob Dylan, asked the relevant question.
How does it feel to be on your own?
How does it feel? Horrible. I mean, the average price tag for nursing home care is almost $60,000 a year. Medicare covers very little long-term care. Medicaid does, but only if you're broke. The solution should be long-term care insurance. But here's the straight story. For many people, it's too complicated, it's too expensive, and it's too risky.
Well, it certainly doesn't sound like something that any of us would want to buy then. What is it supposed to pay for?
What long-term care insurance pays for is you get old. You have certain disabilities. A classic test is, let's say you can't dress yourself, so you need long-term care. So it may pay for it in a nursing home if that's necessary. It may be at-home care. Or perhaps you move to an assisted living center, it'll help pay for some of those expenses.
But it doesn't do you any good to have the insurance if the insurance company doesn't pay.
That's right. I think there are a couple issues here. I wish it was simply an issue of fraud or a bunch of bad apples out there. Because you know what? We know how to deal with that.
Right.
Put some people in jail. A couple of good prosecutions. A couple of frail people up on the witness stand. Okay. We deal with that situation. I think with long-term care insurance, the product has only been around since the mid-1980s. It is an expensive product, and it is extremely difficult to understand what this product actually is going to do when you need it. And so my concern is less about fraud, because I think we can deal with that. And by the way, state insurance commissioners, wake up, start dealing with it. But the bigger problem is whether this product makes any sense. The need is there, but I'm not convinced the product is.
What are the insurance companies telling patients in terms of why they're being denied?
Well, from the New York Times story, a lot of the examples was coming up with things that were not in the contract. For example, you needed to spend some time in the hospital first. Okay, well, that's not in the contract, that you have to spend time in a hospital. Mm-hmm. It's really a lot of petty tests that supposedly are in the contract that, according to the New York Times story, were not in the contract.
On the other hand, going back to that number you mentioned earlier, 3 out of 4 of those claims in California do get paid. So it might be wise for some people to buy long-term insurance, right?
If your employer offers long-term care insurance as an employee benefit, I would look very seriously at it because it's a very affordable product.
But wouldn't you want to wait until you're at your final employer? I mean, you don't want to do that if you're in your 30s or early 40s and you might be in a different employer when you retire, right?
Tess, you just hit on one of the huge debates in the industry. Do you buy it when you're in your 40s? You may not need it until you're 75, 83 years old.
That's a lot of premiums.
That's a lot of premiums, but how's the healthcare system going to change over that period of time? Will that insurance company be around over that period of time? So it makes more sense, and more people do this, where they want to look at the product when they're in their 60s, 60 to 65. At that point, however, it's a much more expensive policy. So I'm in the camp that says, look, in your 40s, you need disability insurance. You're paying for healthcare insurance. If you have kids, life insurance. Long-term care insurance falls way down the list unless you make a lot of money or your employer offers it as a benefit.
All right, the straight story from our man Chris Farrell. I guess we just hope at this point that we live forever and never get sick.
Now that is the long-term care policy of all long-term care policies.
All right, thanks, Chris.
Thanks.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, a family business only Uncle Sam could love. Three generations of tax accountants under the same roof.
Years ago, when they came in, they had one piece of paper, and that was a W-2 form. Now everybody has interest, dividends, stock sales, and it's a different ballgame entirely.
And don't forget to play ball with our website. You'll find podcasts, video clips, and a new blog from Chris, all at marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes with Rico Galliano, Nancy Fargali, James Richter, who composed our fairy tale music, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
American Public Media.